me talking a little... on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. First up in our show, we have a panel discussion in regards to accessibility in the city of Toronto, welcoming two of our favorite guests, Samantha Newmarch and Stephanie Kepman, for this on-location piece.
On location. Newmarch and Steph Kempman. We're going to be talking a little bit about accessibility of Toronto. So, can you tell me a little bit about some of the accessible features in the city?
Well, we've noticed ramps and, braille in the elevators. We've also noticed that there are more elevators being put into the TTC system, and although they haven't come out with the new streetcars as quickly as anticipated, they are working on it, and so I think that it's really beneficial that they're actually putting work in now, although it should have been addressed earlier.
So, what are some of the challenges connected with it?
This is staff, by the way. Some of the issues, with dealing with retrofitting, especially buildings with accessibility or accessible functions, is that it costs time, it costs money, and it involves a lot of planning, because you can't just put in a ramp. The ramp has to actually serve a purpose and or be angled properly. As I mentioned to you earlier, I'm trying to volunteer with an organization called StopGap, and they're a not-for-profit organization that helps not-for-profit organizations and businesses become accessible by building custom-made ramps, because Toronto has a major issue with accessibility in bars and restaurants.
So, this question is for each of you. If you could see one thing added to the infrastructure of the city in terms of accessibility, what would it be?
Honestly, my biggest issue is information. I find that the average transit user is ignorant and or apathetic to the plight of a person with a disability. I regularly see people not giving up their seats to people with disabilities, or having to basically be called out, being like, hey, I have a mobility issue, you need to get up. I think that the TTC and the city should probably be running an information, campaign, thank you, to inform people about, like, the plights of people with disabilities. And, you know, even though there is a transition and things are becoming more accessible, the average person still needs to do more.
What do you think, Sam?
As aforementioned, I think that, especially in transit, there needs to be more money and more time spent on building infrastructure to better facilitate people with disabilities.
So, if you could send any message to the city and those in power, those responsible for the planning, what would you say?
This is an issue that needs to be addressed, and it's obviously taken too much time, and I think that we need to put more time into going over the building code to ensure that people of all walks are taken care of before the building is even put up, so that there isn't a pause in day-to-day business where you have to put different infrastructure in to facilitate people with disabilities. Rather, it should already be there.
What are some of the positive points about accessibility in the city?
Well, for one thing, we live in Toronto, so there isn't that much snow. So, it's great that we don't have to rely on the city for plowing, unlike some other Canadian cities. There are lots of businesses and lots of organizations and buildings that are putting an emphasis on accessibility, and as Sam mentioned, actually planning accessibility into the architectural structure and planning of the building. Shout out to Restaurant Di Bistro in Toronto for being a vegan accessible, non-gendered bathroom location, one of the few here that offers such a thing. It's great that there are options here, but there's always more work to do.
So, what do HVU foresee for the future of this work?
Well, I think that if the issues are addressed, especially within the building code, then things will get better in the future. I think that the city of Toronto especially needs to pay particular attention to this because people with disabilities are actually drawn to the cities because there are more facilities that are accessible to them as opposed to small towns, which don't regularly deal with disability issues on such a grand scale. So for the future, I feel as though the city of Toronto really needs to go over the building codes and ensure that everyone of all walks is taken care of beforehand, before they even put the hole in the ground.
I personally challenge any city councillor, provincial MPP, or federal MPP to spend a day in a wheelchair in a major Canadian city and try to get around. There's a lot of work to do, and I think that maybe if people are actually turned on to the experiences of other people and aware of the plights that and challenges that people deal with, maybe they'll actually care a little more. Toronto keeps saying that it's this world-class city. You know, we recently hosted the Para and Para Pan Am Games, and yet I think that we should be a little embarrassed based on the quality of accessible services that we offer. So I think that if anything, Toronto needs to step up to the plate and prove that it's a world-class city in terms of accessibility, if they actually want to be considered that.
I'd like to thank you both for taking the time out to do this.
Thank you, Kim.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Of course.
Okay, so now we can just...
Steph and Sam had exactly the right idea, in so much as accessibility is an upward climb. It's about taking the steps, creating what you can, building on the infrastructure that does exist. And it is a matter of leaders taking responsibility. But the truth is, it's not about singling out Toronto. There are a million great accessibility features there, to be sure. But for any place, there's always room for improvement. There's always the next step that can be taken. Truth of the matter is, a person with a disability has a right to access. And that's something that both Sam and Steph have indicated in their previous interviews. Truth is, they're exactly right. It's not just about what the city has in terms of infrastructure. It is about people. People with jobs and families, hopes and dreams, and their right to get around. Not just for business purposes, but also to take in the rich heritage of a place that they're going. Museums, stadiums, eateries, whatever you have, a person with a disability should have a right to enjoy just as much as an able-bodied individual. We as a society should not be taking it upon ourselves to say, you can come, you can appreciate this, because you or an able-bodied person, you get around this way. Oh, but you get around a little bit differently, so we're going to single you out. No one anywhere has the right to make that kind of claim. The truth is, once you create these systems, these plans for people with disabilities, it's that much easier. You get the heavy lifting out of the way. You make the upgrades you can. And progress is simply built upon that. And it's not as daunting a task as it might seem. Leaders should look at it not as an obligation, not just doing what they legally have to do. They should look at it as a challenge to be that city, to be that group of people that leads the way for the world, that's pioneering in disability rights and advancements, that's creating something actually meaningful. A city can pride itself on its art or its sports teams, anything you want, but can it pride itself on the equality of access granted to those who enjoy them? That is a fundamental question. And things like the AODA, organizations working to create better infrastructure, better accessibility, they're constantly pushing forward. They're constantly saying, how can we adjust this? What innovation can we make to make this a little better? And it's all about working together, getting people with disabilities to say what they really need, what should really be of concern to them. You get them involved with the urban planners, with the architects. They come together on a design, and they create something that has its best chance of providing equal access for everybody. Nothing's 100%, but there is room for improvement for everywhere and everyone. For a city, it's about improving design. For a person, it's about improving knowledge, understanding that these are people with a right to access. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
A Detroit-based cultural arts organization, Heritage Works celebrates the beauty and humanity of African people and world culture through movement, music, and folklore. Heritage Works believes culture is a rich resource for promoting understanding as well as personal and artistic excellence. When children, youth, and adults know their heritage, they raise their gaze, lengthen their perspective, and lift up their expectations for their own lives. Understanding and sharing culture builds a sense of community, develops leadership skills, complex thinking, resilience, and a sense of appreciation, and creates curiosity, confidence, and love. People, especially the young, need to help claim the benefit of this inheritance, the help Heritage Works uniquely provides.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Samantha Newmarch and Stephanie Kepman. They were talking about accessibility in Toronto. This next segment is a post-dated interview, so some of the events referred to may already have passed. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with autism yoga instructor Stephanie John. So tell me a little bit about autism yoga.
I started the program this past spring at the John McGivney Children's Center. They had been looking for someone to volunteer, and I have a career-wise, I have a history of working with children with autism, not specifically in yoga, but doing more applied behavior analysis and behavior modification, and just working with children across all their domains of functioning. And I did a lot of that when I lived out west in British Columbia. And since I moved back to Windsor, I hadn't been in the field as much, and I was kind of missing those kids. So when that opportunity came up, And I am a yoga instructor. I just thought it was, a perfect fit. And the program ran really well at the JMCC. And when it finished, the parents had said, that their children really benefited from it, and they were seeing, results from the program, across the board for them at home and at school. And they were really interested in finding out if I could offer that program for them in the community and keep it as an ongoing thing. So I approached the Windsor Squash and Fitness, which is where I teach yoga at the health club there, and I also teach 8-week meditation courses. And they just thought it was a fantastic idea. They're really in support of, running any type of alternative program or anything that can be in service to the community. So we started that up, and we just finished our second round. And some of my students who've been with me since the JMCC, they're becoming, quite excellent and proficient, and are asking if we can, start to integrate some more difficult poses like shoulder stand and handstand. I'm cognizant to keep in mind that there are other students in the class who are new to the class, or they have, one-on-one support workers with them. So the class it's a nice mix of postures that are going to be accessible for everyone, but also some that, I modify for them to make them more challenging for the students who are looking for that.
So what are some of the greatest benefits for someone with autism?
Autism, it's well established in the research that autism is, one of the components of it is the lack of ability to imitate. And as humans, we learn almost all of our skills from birth through imitation, even starting at the earliest periods of development where we, watch our parents' faces up close, when we're being held in our arms as babies, and we imitate their smiles, or we imitate opening their mouth. And for kids with autism, part of it is that they're not attending, they're not paying attention necessarily to the behaviors and the actions of others. And so because they're not paying attention, then they're also not learning to imitate these skills, which is why in turn sometimes children with autism are said to have a challenge with empathy or sympathy, that when they look at the faces of others, they can't tell that someone is upset, whereas we might look at someone crying and we might feel sadness for them. And that's to do with something called the mirror neuron system in the brain. And this area is also established in the research too, known to be not as well developed in children with autism. So when they're in the yoga class, everything they're doing is imitation. They're watching me, they're listening to the step-by-step instructions, and they're imitating. So the research is showing improvements in imitation skills, which has really far-reaching effects, more than just, I'm able to do downward-facing dog, or, I'm able to stand in mountain pose. The potential for this imitation behavior to have far-reaching effects in their life is very possible, and the research is showing that it does increase imitation behavior. So I'd say that that's probably predominantly one of the most important benefits that I see from it. But if you just give me one second, I'm going to bring up the document that I sent you yesterday. So there was also some research done in 2012, so 3 years ago, in the American Journal of Occupational Therapy. And most kids with autism, they work with occupational therapists to help them manage their behaviors, as well as some of their sensory seeking issues and sensory integration challenges. And this study showed that there was significant decreases in maladaptive behavior in school. So this was when teachers would use a daily classroom-wide yoga intervention. And, the fact that they're using this in schools is fantastic, because I'm also a former school teacher, and I as well used yoga in the classroom to help students just to wind down, to get centered, to help focus their mind after recess. And the fact that this is accessible to children in the classroom as well shows a lot of promise for teachers who might be considering, you know, teaching yoga or meditation or any type of mindfulness in their classroom. There was also another study done 5 years ago in 2010 in the International Journal of Yoga, and it said that there was a program that was run with children with autism, and it said that the study indicates that this yoga therapy may offer benefits to increase imitation, like I had mentioned, cognitive skills and social communicative behaviors, and that the children who participated in the program, they exhibited increased skills in eye contact, sitting tolerance, nonverbal communication, receptive skills, and spatial relationship. And then from this study, actually, the parents also reported that there were changes in the play patterns of these children, the way that they played with their toys, the way that they engaged with their peers. So, I mean, that's fantastic, because we also know that it's well established that autism is also a social communication condition. So anything that we can do to help these kids integrate better with their peers and understand how to engage with others and communicate is just, it's quite profound, actually. And then there was another, this will be the final study I talk about, but in 2011, there was a journal article in the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine, which was measured the efficacy of an 8-week program, which was multimodal. So there was yoga, dance, and music. And they showed that there were robust changes on the core features of autism using the behavioral assessment system for children. So that's called the BASC, or the BASC-2, and the Aberrant Behavioral Checklist, which is called the ABC. So these are some of kind of the diagnostic tools and the measuring instruments that psychologists will use in the field to determine the level of the challenge of the behaviors, as well as if they occur across multiple domains. So, I mean, really, we see, like, in the last 5 years, there's a lot more research coming out about autism in general, of course, but also about some of the benefits of yoga and other types of alternative ways to deal with the challenges. So I think that using yoga is a nice complementary approach. It works well with applied behavior analysis and behavior modification, and anyone who's trained in ABA and in yoga can easily create a yoga program for kids that offers the same types of supports that you would find in ABA and other programs for autism.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
Yoga has this remarkable potential to heal for a person with a disability. The more I hear about it, the more I realize the potential it has for a person with a disability. Truth is, a person with a disability facing their condition with stress is going to take the impact of that much more so than one who simply accepts it as part of life. Not all of life. Fact is, yoga has this potential to de-stress a person, whether they have a disability or not. But when we're out of alignment, when we're out of whack, we feel the strain of these things, and really can make things so much bigger than they need to be, so much worse than they have to be. But also there's the aspect that for someone who doesn't necessarily have the opportunity to make as good use of their muscles or coordination, it gives them that sense of freedom, a chance to focus their mind, and for a time, just to be freed of their disability, in a sense. Because when you're not thinking about it, when you're just living in the moment, you're not ruled by it. And yoga has this great potential for any type of disability, just to give clarity of mind and freedom and a chance to really just to feel better about some things. Previous guest, Samantha Newmarch, talked about her experiences as a yoga instructor, and she mentioned just how calming and how freeing it can be. And this really spoke to me in thinking that a person with a disability who sees it as this immovable object in their lives, this enormous weight that they have to carry around, they don't have that sense of clarity, that sense of freedom. But it's techniques like this that can really open their minds. Because if your mind tells you you're at peace and that you're all right with the world, then it is true. Reality is simply based on perception. If we see the world as a stressful, broken place, that's exactly what it is. But if we see it with optimism and with strength, and we see that there are, in fact, methods, pain reduction, stress reduction, we start to think, maybe there's hope for the world yet. Maybe there's hope for me as a person to do more than what people would expect, to achieve those things that matter to me. I love hearing about yoga programs for people with disabilities, always wanting to expand, always wanting to take the next step. Because the truth is, it's fine to have such programs, but you should always try and cast as wide of a net as you can. Reach as many as you can. Because any person, whether they have a disability or not, does have the potential to change the world. Even if it's not something obvious, if you change one life, that life goes on to change another. A person with a disability should never underestimate themselves or their impact on others. For it's all a matter of attitude. A person with a disability reaches out, tries to make friends, they'll have a much better influence on society than one who simply says, I'm ruled by this pain, it's hopeless, there's nothing I can do. My theory is, was, and ever shall be, try it before you say it doesn't work. It doesn't have to be that every technique of stress reduction or pain reduction works for you personally, but if you try it and you find what works for you and what doesn't, eventually you will come to a better place with things. You will find your own rhythm of handling your condition. The only question is, how will you handle it? Will you be that someone who's willing to try something new? Take a step to make your life a little better? Or will you choose to say something like yoga's too new agey and I don't see how it'll work for me? There are those who would take such a position, but, well, reaching out, trying something new, is also a part of disability life. It's a matter of giving yourself the best opportunity you can, recognizing your value, your place in the world. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.